Let me introduce our speaker to you, and I don't want to tell you much about her experience, because that's what we have her here for. But Bonnie Burrows is, proud to say, a personal friend of mine. I actually met Bonnie after one of her first presentations here that I was aware of. She had an extraordinary near-death experience. Some of her abilities associated with that when she was a child are just fascinating, as well as she had probably two experiences, and I'll which one or both of those she wants to talk about. What I thought was some really great insight in a particularly difficult time in my life, she had some insights from her near-death experience that were really helpful for me. Without further ado, let me just turn the time over to Bonnie Burrows.
I'm not real sure where to start because there are a lot of you here who have heard me speak before. I guess I'll start where the introduction to my book starts. I'm going to start with my most recent near-death experience, because that's the one where I learned about near-death experiences. Before, what I had before, I didn't have a name for it. My first NDE was when I was an infant. I don't have the memory of that, and I'll tell you a little bit about that after a bit. My second NDE was when I was somewhere around 6 years old and I drowned. Jason McClurk and I disagree because I didn't think that was a near-death experience because I came out of my body, but I didn't the earth. And I'll tell you a little bit about that, hopefully, if I don't run out of time. Back in 1975, I was 28 years old. I was carrying my last child. I lived on a farm. I was pretty much just a country girl, a little farm girl, and grew up and became a farmer. So I wasn't real wise to the ways of the world, hadn't spent time in the cities, didn't do TV and things like that. You know, you're out on the farm working a lot of hours. I was 6 months pregnant with my last child, and I developed a pulmonary embolism in the deep vein on my right leg. Put me in the hospital, and they were feeding me a lot of heparin, you know, pumping heparin into me, and they couldn't get my blood within. And I'd been in there about a week when I got really, really sick one morning. I just was just nauseous and feeling terribly ill. Had no idea what was wrong. And, you know, you're a farmer, and, you know, if your arm isn't dangling or you're not bleeding a lot, you just kind of keep on going. So, you know, I'm in the hospital, what am I going to say? Nurse, I don't feel well. And so I didn't do anything. And I was just laying there trying to pull, you know, how your consciousness is kind of way out there, and when you're ill, you kind of pull it in and you kind of wrap it around you and focus on trying to feel better. That's what I was doing when I just came out of my body. I just popped out, and I found myself up in a corner looking down, and it was like I was a little bird spirit or a little butterfly. And I was just looking down there, and I felt just fine now as long as I was up there. And The diet aid bring your meals. Diet aid came in after a while and brought my lunch. Told me my lunch was there and put it on the little table. And at that time in life, I did what was expected of me. I had been doing what was expected of me for a lot of years. And so I knew I was expected to eat that meal. So I thought, I really need to go down and eat my lunch. And every time I thought about that, it was like I started to feel sick as my consciousness started to think of that going back into that body. So I'd sit up there a little bit more and I'd think, I really should get down and eat that. It just, you know, I didn't like the way I felt when I would start to think about doing that, and so my consciousness would just back up there, snap right back. Anyway, as I'm doing this, you know, my thoughts back and forth, the diet aide came back in, and she didn't ask me if I wanted that meal. She just came back in, picked that tray up, and out she went with it. And I had this horrible feeling. I could feel her, not exactly thoughts, but her total attitude. And her total attitude was, carry the tray in, carry the tray out. That was her job. She had no connection at all with the people she was supposed to be serving. It was just a nasty feeling, and And I just felt sorry for people who were treated as non-persons, and I felt sorry for the people who were treating them as non-persons, because they were, I realized they were missing so much, and I didn't realize it in the sense of the consciousness of judgment, like, you know, you should do better than that. It wasn't like that. It was like, it was just this was a part of reality. And right on the heels of that thought, I was struck with the times that I had unconsciously treated people as non-persons. And that was kind of a theme. That's been kind of a theme throughout that NDE and in my life since. I'm very good at becoming judgmental. I've had that, you know, been brought up short, especially like with family members. You know, this person could do better at this or that. It seems that every single thing that I judge, I get to experience. You know, how could you do that? How could you do that? Down the road, I find myself in a situation. It may not be the exact same thing, but it's something that will connect right back. I am doing, it may manifest a bit differently, but I'm doing the very same thing that I judged for. So that's kind of been one of those overall things that I guess I have to say I suffer from now. You know, I don't like it, but I grow because of it. But let me go back to the NDE. As I was having all these feelings, I was kind of overwhelmed with that, and I was missing my children. I had a 4-year-old and an 11-year-old, almost 12. I was missing them. I hadn't seen them since I was in the hospital. In those days, they didn't let children visit on the maternity ward because I was pregnant. I was on the maternity ward. And as I'm thinking about my youngest son, he had been ill when I had gone in the hospital. And it, you know how you kind of yearn toward the child? And that feeling, it just took me out of that room. Out of that hospital room, and I just went right to where he was. I didn't, no thought about it, no conscious thought, no directing from me. I wasn't supposed to do that. It was like I knew what was going on. I knew and understood. And so I went to where he was. He was with our babysitter. We called her Aunt Pearl. She wasn't a relative, but she was Aunt Pearl to my children. She had had him ever since I went in the hospital. He was just, you know, he's just a little bitty guy, and he had some medical problems, and she was sitting and rocking him. And I'm hovering, I'm just kind of hovering over her buffet there in the sitting room, and I could feel his feelings, and he was mourning. It was like I was lost to him. She was singing him a lullaby. I went down and I just wrapped myself around him. And I don't know how to explain that because I really, size doesn't seem to have a lot to do with anything once you're out of your body. At least that's my experience. And wrapping my arms around him and just folding him up, I could feel him start to dream, to drift off to sleep, and he was dreaming that I was holding him and rocking him. And then he was comforted. My thoughts, without my doing anything about it, they went to my other son. I just went to where he was. He was in a classroom. He was in school. And so, you know, I had no way of knowing exactly where he would, what class he was in or anything at that point. I was drawn right to exactly where he was. And he was confused, and he was hurt, and he was missing me also. I was able to comfort him. He was not able to identify that it was me. My little one was able to identify. I knew that he knew that I was there. My older son was not able to identify that I was there with him, comforting him and holding him. But he felt the comfort. That I knew. So after a while, I was drawn back to the hospital room. I didn't make a conscious choice to make any of those trips, but I did. I just knew and understood. Then back in the hospital room, I'm sitting up on the ceiling, up in the corner. And corners always seem to go to a corner. I don't know why, and I've heard other people say that also. I don't know why we go to corners. corner seem to be significant. But I'm sitting up in the corner and I'm looking down and I'm feeling despair for the situation where people treat each other as non-persons, where they're not emotionally involved and part of, and they don't understand that they're part of each other. I don't see any solution for it, and I don't see that there's anything I can do about it. And at the same time, I'm starting to understand what trials and tribulations in this world are about, what the things that we go through, how they are for our benefit. I start to go through, maybe, I suppose you would say, a metamorphosis of understanding that the trials that my children will have, are having, and will have, are for their growth, and nothing that they experience will be wasted. It doesn't matter how negative it seems to us. And as that understanding comes to me, I start to lean more toward not wanting to be here. I really don't want to be any part of this world anymore. And then I just call them my guides. I know people say you have to name your guides and angels. I don't name them because it's not, their identity isn't something that fits with words, but I know them. I didn't think about it up until that time. They communicated with me and they asked if I was really ready to leave. Did I want to leave? Was I sure? Did I want to make this final transition? And I'm, yes, I went out of here. I'm done. And I was in that point of release this whole world. And that quick, I was gone. I was gone from that room. I was gone from this dimension. I was in a new body. And it was so totally unexpected. I was the same person, but I had a new body. I mean, it's like, I'm like, where did this come from? Nobody told me about this. This is so unexpected. I'm on top of the world, you know. I am just filled with joy. And yet I don't understand where this body came from. And my guides tell me, and it's a mental thing, that it's not words. They tell me that is the body that I earned. And I don't recognize it because it's made up. I caused it to develop to this point by what my actions on earth. That's the reason I didn't recognize it. I wish I had good words. I do not have good words. I really want to transmit to you all of the things that I experienced and all of the things that I learned and all the things I was told, but told isn't even a good word because everything is so full. When we tell each other something, when I try to tell you about my experience, I'm giving you a shadow. And I want so much to find the words, and I just don't do very well at it. Sometimes they come through a little better in my writing. Anyway, I understood about the body. I understood that, I don't know that I want to use the word reward, but it's kind of like that. That's the best I can do from my religious upbringing. I suppose that I would say that, or someone would say that. And then I'm in this wonderful place. It's like this incredible meadow, but it goes on forever, at least as far as I can see. And I can feel everything there. One of the things that you need to understand, or I'd like you to be able to understand, is about time and sequencing. Sequencing is something that we do. We do number one, number two, number three, number four. But there, it's like you can have things happening simultaneously, but we can't express it here. So sometimes, you know, I've got to move into a linear way of thinking or a linear way of talking, but that's not exactly how it is. This is all going on at the same time. I'm in the meadow. I have these beautiful mountains around me. I have this incredible, wondrous sky and flowers and birds and the grass. And the grass is under my feet. I can feel it. And everything there is welcoming me. It's like they missed me. You know, they're welcoming me back. They missed me so much. They love me so much. And the colors are like They're like nothing I've ever seen. They're like nothing that my eyes can perceive here. Everything is sentient. The grass is making love to my feet. The flowers are making love to me. And the colors are sentient. It's not like you have a red rose. It's not like you have a purple hibiscus. It's like you have a hibiscus. Here's a hibiscus. And the color purple lends itself, gives itself to that flower so that the flower can be more beautiful. Everything is like that. It is just, it's so incredible. The person that I most wanted to see, or most would have wanted to see if someone had asked me prior to this, was my father, who had passed on just earlier that year. So he was the first person who met me. We have this wonderful, wonderful conversation, and I'm not going to go totally into it. If you've read my book, it's in there. What happened was there were things between my dad and I, as there are between all parents and children. I had this feeling of guilt because I had left the hospital. I had left to go to a class. The doctor told me he's doing great. My sister and brother-in-law were there with him, and Daddy said, go to your class. Don't miss your class. And so I was taking this college class, and so I went to that class, and he died while I was gone. And so I had this horrible feeling of guilt about that. So I was saying, I am so sorry, Daddy. I am so sorry. I left you, and I shouldn't have left, and I wasn't there with you. And he's told me that he left while I was gone because my love was holding him, and it was time for him to leave. And he couldn't leave because he loved me so much. So he couldn't leave with me there. He let me know that he had planned it. And then all of the other things we were able to not discuss so much as just meld our thoughts, our minds, our everything, experiences together and see and know. Out of that came this incredible forgiveness. I mean, it was a total reunion, a literal reunion. It was just wonderful. Let's see, what else do I want to tell you about that? There was a lot of things that happened during that, in that space there. I had a sister who was stillborn just prior to my being born, a couple of years prior. I was the first surviving girl. They had pictures of her in her little teen casket, and so that's the only knowledge I had of her, the sight I had of her. But somehow I have this vision of her as when I was a young child. I had this vision that was beyond what that picture was in the casket. My brother was there holding this little baby, and I knew that that baby was my sister, Jane Marie. There were other people there, other family members. I wanted to hold that baby this is the baby that my mother was heartbroken, felt responsible because she had strangled, the Jane Marie had strangled during birth. So I wanted to hold that baby, and I reached out to take her, and my dear sweet grandmother, who was one of my favorite people in the whole world, she put her arm out and she said no, and she wouldn't let me take the baby. And I don't think she had ever been sharp to me in my whole life while she was alive. I said, I want to hold Jane Marie, and she said no. Why? Ed's holding her. I want to hold her. And she said, Ed belongs here, you don't. And it just was a shock. How could I not belong there? This was where I belonged. I knew I was home. Let's see. What else do I want to tell you? I have to pick and choose what I tell you because I always run over time. I've never gotten through this whole story. And I've never, ever tried to put the other two experiences into the time. So what I'm going to do, I'm not going to cover a lot of the stuff that's in the book because you can read about it. You can get the book or you can borrow it from one of your friends or whatever. One of the things that people ask us about, those of us who have had NDEs, is about future events. And most of us don't do the prophesying, I suppose you would call it. And I don't either. And one of the reasons is that I learned on the other side that the things that happen and are going to happen in this earth are dependent on mankind. I grew up with hellfire and brimstone. God's going to punish you. You know, God's going to get you for that. I worried about sinning and all of those things and making sure that I repented, and asked for forgiveness and things. One of the things I learned is asking for forgiveness is very important. I grew up with that thing of punishment. You know, God's got to punish you. And what I learned over there is that we punish ourselves. I learned that in my life review. So I guess I should tell you a little bit about my life review. I was taught that there would be a judgment day. And, you know, depending on who the preacher was preaching in whatever church I was in, it was either that God was going to judge me or Jesus was going to judge me or God and Jesus and all the archangels. So, you know, and it was going to be terrible. My life review wasn't like that. And I've talked to and probably several hundred people now who have had NDEs. And, you know, I didn't know about NDEs before. Everyone says about the same thing. There was a presiding being at my life review. I'm in this place and my guides are there. And there is this wondrous presiding being, and there are a lot of angels. My heart was so drawn to that person who was presiding, who was in charge, whatever you want to call it. And I just wanted to fall down on my knees. But I also realized something else that was different than what I had been taught. I had been taught that you have a hierarchy in heaven, and this one rules and rules, you know, and whatnot. I realized that the power and everything, this person wasn't seeking power or trying to be greater. It was all of the love from everyone and everything else. Everyone knew how great he was. You could feel it. And he asked me a question, and he said, "How have you lived your life?" My feeling, everything in me, said, "Master, I have failed. I have failed." And he just looked at me with all of this incredible love, and he said, "No, my child, you have lived." And it was like, that was a whole new thought. And then he summoned my life. I will be here for a long time if I go into that, very much of the life review. I've written a bit about it, several incidents that I've gone through. What I discovered was, as those things came up, whatever I had done, if I had done something good, I knew it and felt it. And it wasn't, I felt the good that it had done for someone else. And I felt, I got to be that person. I got to be all of the people that affected all the way, even if I had never met them. I got to live that part of their life that I had something to do with. And by the same token, the times when I hadn't been loving, when I hadn't been kind, even when I thought I was being, those things I got to experience also. For instance, there was this little boy when I was in second grade. Now, I grew up, I was a poor little farm kid, you know, and I grew up in a quite well-to-do county back east. And so, but I was a poor little farm kid, and farm kids were, you know, a little bit there. But there was a little boy when I was in second grade who I thought was quite, everything was, he had a wonderful life. He lived near the school, he got to go home for lunch every day, had a beautiful mother, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, his dad drove a new car, the whole bit. But he was shy, and he would be slouched down. The teacher would come and grab him, and she'd say, "Sit up! Are you a fish bait? Don't you have a spine?" And in doing that, and she'd do this, I don't know, seemed like every day, probably wasn't every day. And he would slowly slump down. You know, I got picked on a lot because I was just going to those poor little farm kids. And I was scrawny. I was so scrawny. It was just one day, everybody was picking on we'll call him Jim. Everybody was picking on Jimmy. And I went to help. You know what it feels like to be included? You know, when you haven't been included and they're letting you come and help pick on Jimmy. And Jimmy wet his pants. And Jimmy was just snuggled down by this tree. And nobody was touching him. We're just picking on him, saying nasty things like little kids do. I got to live that, and I got to live, be in Jimmy's mind and body when all this happened. And it was terrible, and I found out things that I didn't know about him. He was, this little boy was, and his mother were both quite abused. I got to live through that and the effect that I had had and that picking on him had had with his, that day. And it was terrible. Here we rationalize, you know, here we say, you know, what were you, an 8-year-old kid? Big deal. You know, kids do this and it's no big deal. There's no rationalizing over there. Rationalizing is like a shield. It keeps you from feeling things. It keeps you from feeling responsible. And I discovered that I didn't have that. I had no shield. And it was just, it was devastating to me. It was just, it was terrible. There were a lot of other things that happened in the life review. My family, in this day and age, would have been considered dysfunctional and abusive. And I wore marks from being whooped many a time. My mother would get hysterical, and she was very religious, and if you told a lie, and you didn't even know you were telling a lie, but you had to be beat because the religion said you'd have to beat the devil out of the kids. I was very resentful. One of the things that happened is I got to go through a lot of the family things, and as I went through them, I got to be them. I was my mother. I was my father. I was my brother. I came out of that experience realizing that my family hadn't tried to be abusive. They hadn't wanted to be abusive. They were trying to raise me by the rod. The rod was the Bible, and the rod that corrected you was the stick. And so, you know, you spare the rod, spoil the child, and they want to make sure that didn't happen with me. I understood in ways that I have no way of telling you, unless I stand here for a long time and tell you all the stories. Because there's no rationalizing, because I didn't have that shield, I was devastated at all of these things. You can just imagine the pain that I caused, and then the pain that was caused through what I had caused. If it had not been for this incredible being just channeling love, flowing love into me, and all of the angels around me, I could not have survived that. And, you know, you think, oh, you're dead. What are you talking about surviving? My body was dead. We're more alive. I was more alive there. I was more alive from the instant that I left here than I have ever been in this life. Like being in a shroud, being stuffed into a shroud, and you're stuck, and it's too little for you to fit. Every person in this room, every single person, is so much more than what can be seen. You know, you extend into the next person, into the next person. We're all connected, but we're all so much more. And so when you get out of this body, you're really alive, and you get to experience all of you. That's a really neat thing. That's a really wonderful thing. So survival is different than physical death. I don't know what not surviving is. All I know is that terrible pain, the only thing that could take it away was the love coming to me. I'm going to jump over some things. I'll hit on them very lightly. Those of you who have read the book, you know, you've already read it, you don't need to hear it, because you probably came to hear something more. At the end of that time, each time along the way, by the way, here I go. I told you I'm disorganized. And if I write it down, I lose it. I lose track of it anyway. It makes it worse. My dad, when I was still in the meadow, told me I needed to go back. Why would I want to go back? And he told me I needed to give birth to the child I was carrying. And I don't understand, because here I am. I'm with him, this person who I had missed so much, and I'm home, and he's telling me, go back into that dark world. And when he tries to explain this to me, every time he is saying to me, you want to go back. It wasn't being ordered back. It's, this is what you want to do. You want to go back. You want to do things. You have decided. You have made this plan. You talked to this child. You promised this child. You want to, and I'm like, no, I don't want him back there in that awful place, awful mess. I don't want him back there. I want him here where there's light and love, and it's wonderful. At every stage, at every step, I was told or asked to go back. I was reminded that this is what I should be doing, this is what I wanted to do. You know, there was enough of my earth consciousness, apparently, and enough of my stubbornness that it was like, why would anybody want me to go? I think I want to go back. I'm trying to tell you, I want to be here. I'm done. This is where I belong. After the life review, once again, I was told that I wanted to go back. I needed to go back. I wanted to go back. And I didn't want to go back. I then got to meet a spirit who I knew was my divine mother. Now, you have to understand, those of you who know fundamental Christianity, it's very patriarchal. The only women in heaven are women who have gone there and become sexless because you were so good on earth, or the angels. That's all I had ever heard about. And heaven forbid that you talk about the Virgin Mary as a saint. That just didn't do. And so here I am confronted with this incredible spirit that I know is very feminine. And it's her attributes. It's not sexuality, it's her attributes. And she was perfect. And she is holding me and she's comforting me. And I do not relate her to, I suppose if I had been raised Catholic, I would have equated her to the Virgin Mary. I didn't. She was my spirit. She was my divine mother, and I knew that. And she held me, and she comforted me, and all of that love just flowed into me, and I once again became whole. And she showed me the perfect being that I am. She showed me that I really was a child of God. She, all of these things, and I wanted so much to be like her. I wanted to be everything that she was. And she told me she would teach me to be as she was. But I had to come back to earth and had to have a lot of experiences and go through a lot of pain and a lot of difficulty to grow into that. And I had to invite her to teach me. And I knew that it wasn't going to happen. There was just no way. No matter how much I wanted to be like her, there was no way. I was done with this earth. She showed me something else. She showed me the incredible divine being that everyone else is. I understood honoring. I understood why Jesus washed the disciples' feet. It was one of those things that was one of the questions, you know, in church and religion that I had. Why did Jesus need to wash the disciples' feet? It didn't make sense to me, you know, and why did he need to do this? And why did he need to do that thing? And especially, why did he need to die on the cross and be ridiculed and abandoned and all those things? As she showed me the divinity of every soul, I understood that how wonderful it is when I could see the divinity of another soul. The joy within me was incredible. The joy just magnifies. Look at Mother Teresa. She was filled with joy. She saw the divinity in every soul. She worked with the poorest of the poor, and she loved them. All you saw was joy on her face. Maybe that's a little better than my story, and, you know, because we all saw her life, the things she did. And I was privileged one time to pass through the airport where she was with her group, and just to pass them, you know, to stand and stare, really, was amazing. If we could just see each other in the way that she was able to show me, we would be so filled with joy and so happy. Sometimes I need to work on that, especially depends on what someone else is doing at the moment. Anyway, I wasn't coming back, not even to work and become like my divine mother. At that point in time, my guides left me. I say at that point in time, somewhere in all of this, it was somewhere about the somewhere in my refusal to come back, my wanting to move on. And I got two guides. I got one who was a teacher and showed me things. I wanted to see one of the things I wanted to see was the end of the universe. I wanted to see history, and I wanted to see how we had become what we were. And I got to do that. I got to, it was like, oh, okay. And it was like this spiral going back. And it was like I could go into it at any point, and my guides would go with me, and or take me, or open the door, or whatever, however it was, because it isn't something that I can describe here. And I can look at that. You know, being smart beings, we're kind of dumb. You look at the thousands of years, and we're still shooting each other. Everything I looked at was like that. It was like the solutions were so simple. The answer was always love. And instead, we, all the way back through, we would, invent a new way of killing, a new way of beating up. And it was just amazing. Then I wanted to see the end of the universe. I have this, still have this brain that wants to know how things work and where's the end and what's the start and everything. And I was told there is no end to the universe. And try to wrap your mind around the idea that there's no end. There's no way to get to an end because there is no end. Well, if you think about it, we can't even imagine that. Because what's on the other side? It's just more universe. That was one of the things that I understood it there. But my finite mind still won't wrap around it here. There's just no way. And so I got to see a lot of things. I'm still writing, and probably for the rest of my life. I talked to Betty this morning, and I said, I printed out this stuff that I'm, organizing into this next book. And it took me two reams of paper to do it. It still isn't a book. So I'll probably be writing for the rest of my life to finding ways to express some of these things. That silent spirit that I didn't understand what it was about, who it was about. People, my friends have said when I've talked about it, they've said, well, what was he about? And I finally figured it out because at the time when I finally decided to come back, and I didn't exactly decide, but I did, he touched me. And when he touched me, my consciousness of what my earth responsibilities came back to me. And the only thing that my finite mind can grab onto is that he held my earth consciousness for me, because without the earth consciousness, I could not have come back. It took me a long time to find that answer, to figure that out, and to put all the pieces together. Because it sounds pretty easy. He touched me, they came back, okay, that's what it was. But it isn't exactly like that. It's so multidimensional that I had to get the pieces. I had no intention of coming back still. One of the things, I didn't have the experience of a lot of buildings and walls. There were several times. One is, my Christian upbringing was that you die, go to heaven, you get your reward. In my house there are many mansions. You're going to get a mansion when you get to heaven. And so one of the things that happened was I asked about my mansion. I said, I was taught that there are mansions in heaven. There were, and this is kind of funny. It was kind of funny then. So he said, oh, you want a mansion. You want to see the mansions. And all of a sudden, I was there, and they were there all of a sudden. And I never know if I moved places or those places moved to me, but they were real. They were real. They were solid. The mansions were incredible, and we're standing outside this one, standing, floating, kind of. I said, "Is this mine?" And he said, "It will be." And I said, "Oh, I want to go in." And I couldn't go in. He told me I couldn't go in. Let me know I couldn't go in. And so that was my experience with mansions. So I think that, if I had wanted to have a different experience, then I would have had that. I could have had that. But always there was a logic to everything, but I could not go in that mansion. One of the other things that I grew up with was hellfire and brimstone. Got to go to hell, you know, bottomless pit, all that kind of stuff. The only experience that I had that would equate with that was, okay, I got to see a lot of other spirits there. I got to see, we were all, well, I wasn't. I was looking. I was touristing. But everybody else was doing something. You know, nobody was floating on a cloud playing the harp. They were working. They were doing something. They were growing. This one place, there were people going through their life review, and it's not like I saw the thing that they did and then the result. I didn't see the manifestation so much as I saw the spiritual message, the spiritual thing that they were going through. But this one place was like, there were souls that were, they were working on their life review. They were in such horrible pain that it had to be contained in that space. And there were walls, but it was gray and it was dark. And there were angels helping them work their way through. If it had not been for the angels loving them and giving them love, I don't know what would have happened. It was like they were shattering and the angels were bringing the pieces back, almost. And I was taught that, you know, you go to hell and it's terrible and you're miserable and you're separated from all wonderful things. And so, but that was the only thing that I knew that I could not. It was a place I could not go, and I knew that I could not have stood the pain, even for a second, had I gone in there, because it was just terrible pain. And so I think that, you know, when people have done terrible things against humanity, I think that that's probably where they are, and heaven knows that, I guess it is an eternity of working those things through. Obviously, I came back. Each time, there was one other thing. This was one of those things that there were these spirits that were carrying gray burdens, grayness around them, gray clouds. And there were these other spirits that were bright and shiny, and their light was like purple. And when I've written about them, I wrote about them 20 years ago. I call them my spirits of purple lights. Today, I believe that those are the indigo children that other people are referring to. But I had never heard of indigo children, so when I was writing about it, when I wrote it too, tried to pull everything and put things into words, that they were my spirits of purple lights. And I asked what was going on, and my guides took me closer. And what was happening? And they said, these are the ancestors teaching the spirits who will be born. And I got to go and listen to the ancestors teaching. And they had already been through their life review. They were still carrying pain, and they were trying to teach their children who would be born to resist the things that they had taught and lived back when they were on Earth. And I got to hear some of those conversations. What I learned out of that is we're all connected. I am my mother. I am my grandmother. I am all the way back. And I used to listen, when I was a kid, I used to listen to the old folks talk, and they would talk about this thing and that, talk about that thing in the past, and I thought, how stupid. You know, what a waste of time. Who cares if Aunt Tilly, you know, Aunt Tilly was married 3 times. Who cares if Aunt Tilly did this or that? Who cares if, you know, Uncle Gene was a drunk 3 generations back? What I learned in this part of that tourist trip, what I learned was that we have things to overcome within our families. We carry those things down, and I think John Bradshaw said something similar. He said, if you don't pass it back, you pass it on. And that's as close as I had heard in the psychology world. We do carry those things, and when we overcome them, our children don't have to. And it doesn't matter that our children are grown. It doesn't, but what we don't bother with, what we don't try to do anything about, our children then are left, our grandchildren, et cetera, down the road. And I don't know if I'm saying that very well. I'm sure somebody has said it better. I can tell you this, back before I had my NDE, I would have laughed at anybody that said anything like that. It's there. Anyway, I toss that out for you to do with what you will. I guess I'll bring me back. All of this time, each time I was told that I needed to come back, I was once again, I was presented with the thought, the concept that I was the one who wanted to come back. And I couldn't understand it. Oh, by the way, I met a soulmate. I met future grandchildren. I met people who I have met here now as adults that had not yet been born. All of those things. There were so many things. And I'm struggling here to say, oh, shall I expand on this one or shall I expand on this one? But I better bring me back. Finally, when I just was, you know, I'm doing all of this and I'm refusing to come back and I'm refusing to understand, or it's just the concept of needing to come back and why I would want to come back isn't hitting me. They brought my unborn son. Now don't ask me how they did this, because I was 6 months pregnant, but they brought him to me, and he was like, he was an adolescent, and he communicated to me that I had promised to give birth to him before I was ever born. Now, this is a totally crazy concept for me. I mean, y'all, if you're not LDS, you at least have been around LDS people enough to have heard of pre-existence. But I had never heard of such a concept. You know, in the religion that I grew up in, you came into being at conception. Before that, you didn't exist. And now, here is my son, who is not yet born, telling me that I have... This is what we had planned. This is what I had agreed to prior to my ever being born. There was a lot more than that. It was like this child opened my mind, if you will, my infinite mind, places in my infinite mind, so that I could understand the need for him to be born. And I knew that I needed to do that, but I really didn't want to come back. And so now I'm in a place where I've got my son. I have a bunch of elders, is the only thing I know to call them. They were kind of like a committee or something. And my dad is there, and angels and stuff. Okay, I will go back and give birth to this child if you promise me that as soon as he's born, I can leave. And they promised me that I could leave and come back, go back at his birth. He promised me that that would be fine. It wasn't like, there was no judgment. Nobody, this was perfectly fine. I could make whatever choice. And so I agreed to come back. And when I agreed to come back, the silent spirit, the silent guide who had been accompanying me through all of this with the other guide, touched me, and that's when all of my consciousness of this life came back in the way that I perceive it here, okay, because we perceive things differently on the other side. I came back, and I am up in the corner looking down on this ugly, just incredibly repulsive thing that I'm supposed to go back in, and it's like, You know when you make bread, you know how farm women, we make bread, 4 o'clock in the morning, we beat it and pound it up and we put it to rise, and then we get busy, and then there's an emergency, and then the cows get out, and the next thing you know, it's 6 o'clock at night, and you've forgotten the bread, and now you're madly getting something to eat for everybody, and finally you get everybody to bed, fed and to bed, and the dish is done. And you walk in the pantry to put the dishes away, and there's the bread. And it's gray, and you know, it kind of has, and it's rose. Finally ran out of everything that it needed to keep on rising, and all the sugar was gone, and it just collapsed. Well, that's what that body looked like. And it's just about how appealing it looked, too. And I'm sitting up there looking down and thinking, there is no way. There is just no way that I can go back in that body. And I'm sitting up there and I know I have to go back in that body, and I can't. The diet aide, a different diet aide, walks in. She brings my supper. So it's about five and a half hours in between those two meals. She walks in, she sets the tray down, and I'm sitting up here while the body is curled kind of in a fetal position, facing the window. I had a roommate. As the diet aide is walking out, my roommate says to her, "You better check on her." Now, you've got to understand, both of us were on total bed rest. We didn't even get up to go to the bathroom, which was right there. We were not allowed to put our legs down over the side of the bed. She said, "Somebody better check her. She has not talked to me. I've tried to talk to her all afternoon. She doesn't respond. She hasn't moved since this morning. Da, 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 da." The little diet aide comes around. These are high school kids that do the nighttime. She comes around, and she looks, and she goes running out of the room. And she runs to the nurse's desk, and she says, "That lady in there is dead." And so the nurse jumps up and she's coming in, the other one's right behind her, and of course, first thing they do is they throw a blood pressure cuff on. They're just going bonkers. You know what's going through their mind? Not that poor lady. It's after 5 o'clock. They change shifts at 3, and they're supposed to run. At that time, I don't know how it is here, but at that time in that hospital, and I know because I used to work in that hospital, you check everybody's vitals when the shifts change. And I was just a fixture on the ward. No problems. All you have to do is give me the shots, keep the IV going. Nobody had checked on me and I was cold. And I could hear their thoughts. They shoved my roommate's bed out of the way, and they're pushing my bed out the door, and they're running down the hall because they have nothing on the maternity floor to resuscitate people. The one is saying, "We've got to get her down to do a C-section." The other one's saying, "She's dead, the baby's dead, she's cold." And they're in front of the elevator, and they're saying, Where's that elevator? And their mind is saying, "Gotta lose my job, gotta lose my license, da 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 da." And somehow, and I'm up here, somehow I knew that if they got on that elevator, my baby was going to die. It was all over, because 3 floors down, and that would be it. Elevator, you know how it dings, and then the doors open? The elevator dinged, and when it dinged, I went back in my body, and I drew a breath, and two nurses, one on each side, and they go like this. They said, one of them said, "She's back," and the other one said, "What do we do?" And he says, "Back to the room." They did take me back to that room. They took me to a room where nobody else was. And I was in horrendous pain. I have no idea. It was crazy. I mean, I had so much attention. And that night, it's like a blur. I was half in, half out, and it was really crazy. I was in the hospital another almost 2 weeks. Anyway, that's my coming back part of the story. When I was finally discharged from the hospital. Oh, I got lots of attention, by the way, that next day. That night and the next day, and from then on. They were pretty scared. I knew I only had 3 months to wait, and I was out of here. I was gone. I had 2 children, and I'm going to have a third. So now I'm going to have 3 little boys, and they're going to be motherless. And so I told my husband that I didn't think I was going to. You know, you can't say, "I'm going to die when this baby's born." You can't say, in the circles that we traveled in, you can't say I had a spiritual experience, because that probably means you got demon-possessed or something like that. I can't talk about this. If I talk to my pastor about it, really bad, really, really bad. You know, they would have had an exorcism, or they would have had me on tranquilizers or something. So I tell my husband and my doctor that I tell my husband that I don't think I'm going to live through this, and he needs to start looking for a new wife because my kids need to have a good mother. I tell my doctor, "You have to make a decision. This baby has to live." And so he thought it was bonkers. And I said, and he said, Bonnie, we don't lose mothers in this day and age. Long, short story. Anyway, part of this is in this book. There's a lot more in this little book than what I've tried to hit things that I don't have in the book. Anyway, I did look for a new wife for my husband. Everybody thought I was bonkers, but I had 3 months to do it, and I got 3 good candidates too. Anyway, I did not know how to explain what had happened to me. I'm very scientific based in my thinking, and I know that after about 4 minutes you start to have brain damage, and here I was gone from my body for about 5 hours. It seemed impossible. So there were just a lot of things. So how can I talk about this and not sound crazy, even if I tried to talk to somebody else? And of course, I live on a farm outside of small town. I didn't talk to you except the pastor. And anyway, you know how that is. I didn't talk about it for years. And then finally, things started to happen. Somebody would lose someone, and I would talk about it, say, you know, I had this experience, and I'd tell them a little bit. A couple of friends that I would tell a little bit of the story to. And finally, I really want to tell them about the dream before I end. You're going to have to read it, I guess. Anyway, finally, one of my friends called back in 98 and said, there's a whole bunch of people coming to Salt Lake just like you, and they're going to have this conference, and you need to go to it. They've had great experiences, and they call them near-death experiences. You need to go to that. Well, that's how I found Ian's. That was the beginning of my talking about it, but each time I talk, I tell a little bit more, and each time I write a little bit more. It's very hard to do that. It's like putting yourself out there, you know. I call it, when you write about things that are personal and things that you're talking about that happened to you that other people don't really believe in, or a lot of people don't, it's kind of like standing in Times Square at high noon naked. You know what that would feel like. And so, yeah. At that Lions conference, I met PMA Chatwater, and PMA Chatwater has done a tremendous amount of writing. She's had 3 near-death experiences. And she's done a tremendous amount of research with other people. What she was lecturing on at the meeting I went to was the near-death experiences of infants. And I don't know if that's the exact title, but what was amazing to me was she's there telling the markers, and I had all of them. And so I went to her and I said, I have all those markers, but I don't remember the near-death experience, but I can tell you, at 8.5 months, when I was 8.5 months old, all I had done for 8.5 months was scream. You know, if I wasn't crying, I was screaming. And it was a big, the whole town talked about it. And the other thing is, at 8.5 months, I smothered. In 3 weeks, I went from a screaming baby to a quiet, contemplative, walking, talking, potty-trained child at 9 months. And so she said, write about it. I said, well, I don't know how to write about it, but what I know is that what I remember is when I was 11 and a half months, I had pneumonia, I was in the hospital. When they put me in the hospital, I knew everything, and I didn't cry, and I understood. And so after my mother left and everything, I wanted to explore and look at all the equipment. I climbed down to my crib, was looking at things, and I wasn't touching anything. And the nurse, one of the nurses came and saw me, and the other one was right near. For some reason, they used to always have nurses together. Nowadays, you can't find a nurse hardly on my board. And she runs and picks me up, and standing by all this thing that has all the shiny stuff on it. And she says, you can't get out of bed. You've got to stay in your crib. And I said, I was talking. I said, I was just looking. I was looking. And she said, oh, you'll get hurt. And I thought, how stupid, how dumb. This, because I here they my mother was leaving with people in white, and I remembered people in white, and I remembered. And so I thought I was just in a place waiting to go on. You have to understand that babies don't have a lot to, we don't have experiences to know and relate to things. I could relate back to that. Now, what's phenomenal is I don't ever remember thinking like a child, and they used to tell me how precocious I was, and by the time I was 3 years old, I was sitting in and participating in Bible studies and a lot of other things. I was also coming out of my body often. And it was like I would come out of my body to play. My mother would put me down for a nap. Who wants to take a nap? And so, but I had to stay in that bed. And so, and I had, by then I had twin sisters. They were babies, and they were cute, sweet, wonderful little babies. And so I had to lay and take a nap, and so I couldn't sleep, so I would come out of my body and I would explore. You don't know that you're not supposed to tell. And so one day I told my mother about, I had come out of my body and I had gone, walked up on the top of the roof, and we had an old farmhouse, you know, the 3 stories high. And then I had gone down the chimney, and there was it was a fireplace. Now, I don't know, if you go down the chimney, I think it's probably pretty dark, but for some reason, you know, I could see when I was, dark didn't exist. And so when I got up from my nap, I told my mother, I said, why, you know, we read in our family and read books and things out loud, and so I wanted that fireplace. Why couldn't we have opened that fireplace up? Well, it was behind wainscoting. And she said, there's no fireplace there. Since she had lived in that house, or since they had only lived in that house, there had always been the wainscoting. When my dad came in from the fields that night, I said, Daddy, why can't we open up and open the fireplace and have a fireplace, like, you know, da, da, da. And I was probably 3 or 4 years old, and my mom said, I told her there's no fireplace there. And my dad had grown up, his family had homesteaded the next farm. I said, there's a fireplace behind that wood. My mother said, no, there isn't. And my dad said, yes, there is. And there was a fireplace behind there. And there were a bunch of stories like that. So my mother finally told me if I kept doing that, coming out of my body, if I fell, I would die. So I walk under it. And so she tried to scare me out of these things, and she also tried to keep the rest of the family from finding out. Guess I need to quit, huh? Gee, I have a lot more stories to tell.
Well, you can ask them to maybe they'll conjure.
Okay. Anyway, I'm writing about the rest of it, so hopefully by Christmas, huh?
Do you have any thoughts on why you were gifted with more than one NDE?
Well, the first one, yeah, I think the first one was because I was just a crying baby, and I got smothered. The second one, it was a swimming accident, and I went where I wasn't supposed to be. It was back home. We called the horse hole. We'd go swimming there, and my aunt had taken my sisters and my aunt and uncle, and we were not supposed to go past a certain point because it was very, very deep. There was a cliff, underwater cliff, and there was a drop-off. I don't know how much that drop-off was, but being who I was, I had to find out. I wasn't really trying to go past the edge of the cliff. I just wanted to get to the edge, and I couldn't swim. I went off the edge. You know, so that one was disobedience. So basically what happened is I went off the edge and I went down and down and down and ended up in under the water and under the mud and came out of my body and was trying to scream in my aunt's face. And I may as well tell the rest, so I'll take a minute. And I'm yelling at her, and I couldn't get her attention. And I yelled at my uncle, and finally, I'm back in my aunt's face, and she looked around, and she asked where I was. That was then when my sister said that I had gone over where I wasn't supposed to. And they were, you know, almost a year and a half younger. Anyway, my uncle dived, and I remember seeing him hit his knee on that edge of the cliff where the fall off. And he dived and came up without me, and my aunt was screaming. And anyway, he dived 3 times. And I was very peaceful about it. I was just up here, you know, now he's looking. But when he came up with this bundle of mud, and that's what he came up with, I wonder, what in the world is he doing with that bundle of mud? And then he swished it off, and it was me. And then he did the actually, they didn't do CPR in those days. They picked you up by the heels and they whacked you on the back. And that's what he did to me. And so I was small, still small enough. He was pretty strong, too. And I went back in my body and I screamed a lot. And my aunt yelled at me a lot, too. So, and then, of course, the third time, I think that, you know, it was just one of those things if I was working the farm and whatnot. So I don't think it was any, I think I was supposed to be here, and I just kept not wanting to be here, maybe, or not really taking care like I should. So I even though, and I'm not sure an NDE is a blessing, because there are a lot of things that, I mean, you'd think life would be easier, and it's not. It really is much harder, and you understand your responsibility, and you keep growing into that, you know, and you keep those things that you learned on the other side, you keep coming into the human consciousness, and you grow and grow. I think life would have been easier for me without the NDEs.
My question is, being different and your family realizing that you were different, did they try to make you normal and have you not talk about the things that you weren't afraid of anymore, and or talk about people that you saw or things that you understood that other people wouldn't know? How did your family react to you?
The short answer to that is yes, they tried to make me be normal. How they reacted to me was, though I got whooped a lot. They tried to, my dad was kind of open-minded, but he was always working. My mother was very religious, and she was trying to mold me. And back where I come from, you're supposed to break the spirit of the child and mold them into the image that the Lord would want them to be. I actually learned not to talk about a lot of the gifts that I had that I didn't know where they came from. I just thought everybody was like that. When I was 5 years old, this is the typical of the things, this is the one that made the difference for me. We lived down a dead-end lane. We didn't have a telephone. I was out playing, my sisters and I were out playing outside, and I heard the shale crunching under the tires, and I looked up and I saw my uncle's car coming in the road. Now, we had a half a mile private road, and about halfway, most of that was wooded, and so he was about halfway down that lane, which is still wooded. I saw him driving, my aunt sitting beside him, and my little cousin, who was the same age I was, sitting there in the back seat with her legs sticking straight out. And I always remember her legs sticking straight out. And so I'm all excited. I run in the house and I tell my mother, Aunt Betts and Uncle Cliff are coming. And we got little Isabel with them. That was another, that wasn't their child, like I said. And then I went back out to play and my mother's running around straightening things up. And I would see these things and be in that time and still in this time. But then my mother comes out and, you know, some time has passed. And when you're 5 years old, time isn't, you don't tell time on a clock. But some time has passed and they haven't come up around the house. Even at 5 mile an hour, they should have probably by then. And so she yells at me because I lied. And she grabs me and she drags me in the house and she whoops me for being a little liar. So I'm in there crying my eyes out. I was good at crying my eyes out too, I think. In comes my uncle driving the car with my aunt in the car, the said dress that I had described her have wearing, she's wearing. My cousin Elizabeth is in the back seat and she's dressed the way I had said she was dressed. Now my mother is all really upset. I'm in there crying and I'm not allowed to come out to play, and you know, you get company one. My brother, who is 7 years older than I am, comes sneaking in and he says to me, "How do you always know what's going to happen before it happens?" And it was like, I'm totally startled. And I'm like, "Everybody knows." And he said, "No, they don't." And I said, "Yes, they do. You know, too." And he said, "No, I don't." And I'm like, "Yes, you do. You know everything that's going to happen." And he said, "That's not true. If that were true, my teachers would have told me." I was so startled that I quit crying. Now, I'm starting to realize what lying means. It means telling something before it happens. And I never got beat again for telling a lie. Because if that's the day that I learned to keep my mouth shut. I learned that I was different. Before that, I really didn't know. And so it was like I lived two lives. This one was acceptable to the world. And there was this one where I knew things, but didn't talk about them.
I was just wondering, so when your baby was born, what happened then that made you decide to stay instead of deciding you were leaving?
I told my doctor that I wasn't going to be able to have him normally, and he told me that I was, and I said, no, I was going to have a C-section, and that there were other problems, and he said, there's no indication. Long story short on that part, I ended up having to have a C-section. I had difficulty, baby went into stress, there were a lot of things that were going wrong. I didn't want to have any anesthesia, and they had a rule at that hospital that you had to be under general to have a C-section. So my doctor, who was also a friend of mine, said, the very minimum, and he promised me, and so that's what they did. They gave me the very minimum. When they got him out, I came out of my body, and they had other surgeries that they were doing on me, and I was losing a lot of blood, and I came out of my body. I was leaving. I was overjoyed. I am out of here. This baby who I'm looking at, who is this most incredible, glorious baby you have ever seen, who's just alive and glowing. Suddenly, he is still there, and yet he is this adolescent that I saw on the other side. So I know he's the same. And he looks at me, and he's got these beautiful blue eyes. And he looks at me, and he says, don't leave me, Mom, I need you. Was it that instant I realized, I had here those 3 months, I had been looking for the very best wife for my husband and the very best mother, because this child had to have the very best mother. Had to have somebody better than me, obviously. In that instant, I realized that it wasn't the very best mother that he needed. I was the very best mother for him. I knew I could leave him. He was so beautiful. And I thought, I can stay and we can do this together. And I went back in my body. And then they put me way deep under, somewhere in there, and did a lot of surgery. When I came out of that, I knew I had lost my chance to leave. And it was difficult. I went into there's a lot more to it, but it was it was a very dark time for me. Very difficult time.
I just was wondering about, let's see, I guess you can say I have two questions. For one thing, in that supposedly school that the preborn people or infants or whatever you want to call it were supposed to be, what were they, for one thing, instructed to resist that was taught on earth? That's my first question. And the other question is if you can maybe describe what the mansions look like, particularly your mansion. I have a Christian background, and I believe in mansions too, so.
The first question was the school. What they were being taught to resist were the unloving teachings that were given to them that the ancestors had passed down to their children, to their progeny. They were being taught to resist, to change it to love, not necessarily. I would have to, for each individual it was different. For whatever the legacy was that was non-loving, that had come through that family line, whatever the ancestor had taught that was violent or mean or negative or all of those things that we put on that side, those were the things that now he has seen and done his life review, now he is trying to teach the child that will be born to change that, to not move forward with the negative, not move forward with the terrible things, but to move into a place of love, to respond with love. And as far as the mansion is concerned, was a lot of white. I didn't see the inside. I saw the white, I suppose you would describe it as marble, but it was more than the whiteness of marble. It was like light. And the steps, the same, and the streets, you know, when they talk about streets of gold, but it was more than just gold. It's just very beautiful. There was like nothing.
You spoke about the spirits that had yet come to earth that you have met now. Do you recognize those immediately?
Not always, sometimes. Sometimes I don't know why I know them right away. And it'll be a scene from that I was given on the other side that tells me. It's like meeting a friend, but you've never met him before. But you see him, and it's like you feel this instant love. But it's not like a new love. It's like, this is somebody I love that I haven't seen in a long time, and yet you don't know them. That's usually what it's like. I actually had more than two, but I had two really specific incidents where I met someone, and as they were introducing me, I said, oh yes, and I told them things about their life. And I mean, I knew them, and I knew things about their life, and they said, how? And I don't know how. I had an incident in Colorado where I walked into a room and I knew there was someone there that I was connected to, but there was not a person in that room that I had ever met. When it was an all-day meeting and when we came to the break, I just kind of followed that feeling. And I walked up to this person and said, you know, the thing you say, have we met? You know, I have this feeling we've met. And we started talking, we started telling each other about incidents, things in each other's life, but we had never met before, and it was a real, really interesting friendship.
Well, this is a two-part question. Number one, you talked about knowing how your mother felt and things when you were going through your life review, but did you meet your mother on the other side, or had she not?
No, she had not passed yet.
Okay. And so my other question is I've heard you speak before, so I've heard you say that you didn't recognize your son once he was born, and he wasn't that beautiful being. Do you have an extra special relationship with him now, and does he recall anything about asking you to stay?
He doesn't recall. At least he won't talk about it if he does. We do have an incredible relationship. He said to me one time, he said, I don't know why, Mom, but I know that I need to at least see you once a month. And we'll be living in different places. And he said, something happens when I don't see you after a while. And he said, I start to feel something really not good. And so he recognizes that connectedness. I probably need to tell people now what the thing that happened was. Here I had saw this beautiful baby in the operating room, and then I had all that surgery and everything. When they brought that baby to me, he was so fat he couldn't get his eyes open, and he really was not a pretty baby. He was ugly. And I was under medication for several days, and it was very difficult. Time, and I had to have a nurse for when we came home. We had to have a nurse take care of us, and it was a couple of months before I could really be his mother. And so there was a glitch in the middle of all of this.
Well, the time has come. I'll close this. Why don't we give Bonnie a round of applause?